funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why don't the workforces of many American technology and communications companies reflect the diversity of the U.S. population as a whole? The Reverend Jesse Jackson has turned his attention to this question recently and has been meeting with tech sector leaders to ask them to be transparent about the demographics of their staffs and to work harder to ensure they include women and people of color. Jackson's career advocating for civil rights and racial and economic justice spans six decades, including working for Dr. Martin Luther King in the 1960s. He made two landmark presidential runs and led international negotiations to secure the release of dozens of prisoners and hostages in places like Cuba, Kosovo, and Liberia. The Reverend Jackson is in town for an event that just wrapped up at Paul Quinn College, and we are delighted that he could make time to be with us today. Reverend Jackson, welcome to Think.
Good to think with you today.
Think with me today. So how did this issue of diversity or lack of diversity in the tech sector come to your attention in the first place?
Well, as we keep fighting for justice, you know, over time we fought to end the Jim Crow laws which divided us in such ugly ways, the right to vote. And I might add that right to vote struggle, perceived often as just for blacks. The fact is, white women couldn't serve on juries in the South. There were no white women judges. 18-year-olds couldn't vote, though serving in Vietnam. You couldn't vote on college campuses. You couldn't vote bilingually. We changed that dimension of our work. But yet, if you have these political and social rights, don't have economic participation, then something is grossly missing. So we looked at the automotive industry over a period of time, where we were workers, 20,000 auto dealerships, 200 black, 300 Latino. Our numbers are around 30%. We should really have maybe 4,000 dealerships. We have 500. So we spent a lot of time on that. We took a group to Japan about a month ago of people who make products, manufacturers. And Honda has 1,300 dealerships, 13 African-American. Nissan, 1,105 are African-American. It's one-way trade. We want more trade. So auto industry and the banks devastated us with their schemes of lending and targeting people and then using subprime lending schemes on the miners. So we evolved to focus anew on Silicon Valley. It's the number one growth industry in America and in the world. And yet, by and large, we are vast consumers of that industry, but not allowed to participate in a functioning sense. They said, well, the reason you can't participate, you don't have enough high-tech training. That's not true. 60% of those who work in Silicon Valley are not tech. When they do IPOs, initial public offerings, those are not engineering jobs, for example. They use lawyers in advertising and marketing. Those are not high-tech jobs. And if you don't have enough high-tech workers, then train them. What they're doing is using H-1 visas, bringing in Asians to do those jobs, paying them at a lower price. Either bring them in at a lower price or take them to Asia and get the product made at a lower price and then offshore monies, tax avoidance schemes. So we decided to take on this industry and say, let us in. We have something to offer. We have money, market, talent, location, so let us in. If the South is a better South because we open up the doors, high tech can be a better tech industry if we open up the doors.
How responsive have people in the industry been so far? I know Google so far is the only company that's promised to be transparent about the demographics of its workforce.
Isn't that interesting? Here's an industry that prides itself in revealing knowledge and being transparent, and yet they fight against revealing their EEO records. That's because they're embarrassed. I mean, Apple has 8 board members, 7 white men, 1 Asian woman. HP 12 total, 7 white men, 3 white women, 2 male minorities. Arca 26, 8 white men, 1 Mexican man. The point is, in these areas, their role for blacks and Latinos and women should be a part of it, and can earn their way. Verizon did a $50 billion debt offering, $300 million in fees. Not one woman, not one Latino, not one black got a dime of the service fees from those deals. And that's where capital is being generated. That's why you have this huge gap between those who live in the surplus culture, the 1% and above, 0.01, and those who are living at the base with a sinking middle class. So we're saying that the best America is American with doors open. Put it this way. I was talking with some Super Bowl journalists during the last Super Bowl up in New York, and they said, well, why are you here besides enjoying the game? I said, well, you know, the civil rights movement made the Super Bowl possible. They said, what are you talking about? So if we had not pulled the walls down, you couldn't have had the Dallas Cowboys and the Houston Texans behind the Cotton Curtain. We couldn't sit together. We couldn't have played together. You couldn't have had the Atlanta Falcons and the Carolina Panthers behind the Cotton Curtain. You couldn't have had the Super Bowl in New Orleans or in Jacksonville behind the Cotton Curtain. We pulled a little Cotton Curtain. And when the curtain came down, then the South became investment worthy. Thus, high-tech comes to Austin. Thus, Hyundai and Honda and Toyota and Honda. When the walls came down, we all began to grow. And many people attribute their growth to a reason other than why the walls came down. It was not some governor blocking a school door or the like, performing and inciting fear. Dr. King and those who marched pulled down those walls, and when the walls were replaced with bridges, we all became stronger. Well, all that we're really saying, if it was good for the South, it's good for California, it's good for Austin, Texas, it's good for the high-tech industry. We have young men, young women who are fully capable of engaging right now. There's no shortage of people who can serve on those boards and those C-suites, even now, if in fact they're given the basic opportunity.
I know some of these companies have come back and said to you, in terms of our regular workforce, maybe aside from the executive offices and the boards, we're simply not getting applications from a diverse group of people. What do you say to that?
These companies go all the way to China and to Indonesia looking for to find people. And then they lobby on Capitol Hill to get more H-1 visas for them to come in and work. So, and they work for short periods of time. They can't protest. They'll be sent back out of the country. They work kind of under semi-indentured conditions. The issue, if you're looking for an apple orchard, you don't just walk into the forest indiscriminately. You plant apple seeds. You grow apple trees. You grow what you want. So if you want some more blacks and Latinos and women who can become high-tech, then train them. Educate them. We're educable. We're educable enough to fight wars. We're educable. There's nothing we cannot do. Given training, given opportunity. And so that's become a part of the challenge. And the companies, the numbers are so bad, they're embarrassed by making them public. I mean, I watched at the Zuckerberg meeting, and people talking about needing, he was the only engineer there. No one else in the C-suite's engineer except him. People like on the board of directors, none of them are engineers, so that's just a smoke screen. But given their images of being so hip and so with the real deal, I mean, when Google says it has 60% white men and about 30%, 10% white women and about 30% Asians, which are the imports they bring in through the process, and 2% Latinos and 1% blacks, that is so out of connection with their consumer base. And so it needs our exposing it. But the government must enforce EEOC laws, employment laws, contract compliance laws. When that happens, I would rather us expand the private sector and be trapped on the government programs. Expand the private sector, let all people participate and compete. The reason why we do so well on the football field, the basketball court, when Miami and the Spurs play tonight, these games couldn't have taken place in the South had we not been successful. I mean, these games are made possible not because X person owns the team. They couldn't have owned. There would have been no team to own. We made that possible. Tim Duncan could not have gone to Wake Forest had the walls not come down. Well, the walls are down, so now we see growth. We see excitement. We see new possibilities. And that is it could happen in the high-tech industry. We're going to spend a lot of time here in Texas convening people from around the state to focus on the high-tech industry as it grows out of Austin, for example, really in the high-tech center. And I'm excited about the new possibilities of our growth. I found strange that they're fighting to hide the EEO records. They're fighting to hide the records. They should be transparent. They should not. Why are we so good on the football field, basketball court? Because whenever the playing field is even and the rules are public, the goals are clear and the referees are fair and the score is transparent, we all win. They don't want to make transparent their hiring and their intern and their employment and promotion records, but they must. They get tax consideration. They get government contracts. They have a legal and a moral obligation to make their records public in the shareholders' meetings.
Does making those jobs available to a representative percentage of Americans based on demography also have an impact on who has access to an audience for content?
Of course it does, because if you have, since schools are based on the tax base, by and large, if you live in a community where your parents can't get the job, and therefore the tax base is low and your education is low, and those on the low road go to low places. Those on the high road go to high places. But we have a way of picking in those areas out people we think of value. And they may be athletes. They may be a Beyonce as an entertainer. They may be a ball player. But there is more than ball players and entertainers in that ghetto, in that barrio. These young people are separated from the rest of society, not by nature, but by social options, reduced social options. We do better when we have bridges over walls. We do better when we choose schools over jails. I mean, jails, Chicago, we've got 10,000 in one place. We pay $50,000 a year to maintain them, like a jail homeless shelter for the youth in the juvenile section, $90,000 a year ahead. I say invest in schools and training on the front side rather than jails and antisocial behavior on the backside.
I was thinking about you. You have a very active Twitter feed now, and you're deeply engaged with technology.
At Rev. J. Jackson. Follow me and like me on Facebook, Reverend Jesse L. Jackson Sr. Please do it today, right now.
Is that actually you, or do you have a staff member that takes
care of it? Well, staff, I can't do all of it, but I communicate what we want to say. But today, as I was talking to students at Paul Quinn today, you cannot have more votes than you use and spend more money than you have and make it. You cannot vote less than your strength and spend more than your strength and get in debt and break the cycle. These are just like words of wisdom, you know. The situation here that we're facing, the girls in Nigeria. For too long, we ignored, the press ignored what was happening in Nigeria. Nigeria is too big for us to ignore. I mean, after all, 10% of all our production comes from Nigeria, 5 to 10% now. Yet they don't have a refinery. They're still buying gas from other countries that refine it. One fourth of the African continent is Nigerian. It touches one half of the wingspread of the rest of Africans. If Nigeria is in trouble, the whole Western world really is in trouble. And yet we saw Boko Haram in the last 5 years kill 12,000 people and 1,500 people killed this year. And we somewhat thought we could isolate that crisis in Nigeria. We have 8 flights a day coming to America and Nigeria. So if from Houston on United to Lagos, New York, Atlanta, Delta to Lagos, and New York, Eric to Lagos. Now, you can't separate them from both possibilities and danger. After one of the kids who blew himself up coming in Detroit was from Nigeria. So as we fight the world war on terror, don't put Africa in the margins. As we fight for economic growth, don't put Africa in the margins. But this is a part of our work, trying to share a vision of inclusion.
We're speaking this hour with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. He was in town for an event at Paul Quinn College. We'll continue our talk about diversity in the tech industry and the state of civil rights in America historically and today. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is civil rights leader and two-time presidential candidate Reverend Jesse Jackson. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You can also send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So last year, the Supreme Court struck down major portions of the Voting Rights Act, several of which affected the way voting happens in Texas. Now, I know Congress has been working to try and put some of that back together. Right now, it looks to be stalled. How important is it, do you think, that that law is strengthened again?
You know, we are a better nation since all Americans got the right to vote. And I say all Americans because for so long we argued ideologically for democracy. We fought so hard against it. I mean, women finally got the right to vote in the 1920s. I mean, finally got the right to vote. But that was under very limited conditions. That's why I say in 65, August 6th, blacks got the right to vote because of the government intervened and stopped states from denying the right to vote. White women couldn't serve on juries. There were no white women judges on the Supreme Court or state courts at that time. 18-year-olds couldn't vote, no serving in Vietnam. You couldn't vote on college campuses. You could not vote bilingually. And so we are post-Selma to that extent. I want to go a step further and say that when you take voting off of campuses, you discourage students voting. And students are citizens who have responsibilities. And they are right now, those will take us into the next era of our living as a country. So in Texas, where you can use a gun registration to vote, you can't use a student ID. That's just unkind, and it's not good for democracy. When you shorten the number of days, that's not good for democracy. When you make precincts further away from where people live and those who don't have good transportation, that's not encouraging democracy. In North Carolina, they're taking voting off of precincts off of college campuses, supposed to go into the student union and vote. So these schemes to make voting more difficult are showing there's no evidence of fraud. All the studies show the fraud is calling it fraud. This is just voter suppression tactics. That's why you really need an amendment to the Constitution for the right to vote, which we do not have. We have the state's right to vote. It is in the Constitution. It is implicit, not explicit. So to that extent, you can the federal government can stop discrimination in voting, but it's not a constitutional right. Carrying a weapon is a constitutional right. The voting is not a constitutional right. And then we need to amend the Constitution, make that very clear, explicitly. And so long as it's a state's right, various states manipulate. So the election day, we have 50 states separate and unequal election schemes. And many of those schemes are used to suppress the vote. In 2000, the winner lost and the loser won in Florida. Bush won by 512 votes because they stopped the count. The states had stopped the count at noon midnight on Tuesday night. That was a state rule. It left 27,000 votes uncounted in DeVal County. If all the votes had been counted, it had a different outcome. So the winner lost, the loser won. In Ohio in 2004, you had the Secretary of State running the election as a co-chair of the president's campaign. So guess what? You had dry machines in the White House and wet people who couldn't vote. We as a democracy, we fight wars for democracy. We say we love, we cherish. Let the winner win. Let the loser lose. Again, when the big game is played tonight, you may be pulling for Spurs or Heat. You'll accept the outcome even if you lose. Why? Because the conditions are fundamentally just. Court is even. Rules public. Goals clear. Referees fair. If there's a doubt, have a replay. And transparency. Those same rules that make the big game have an acceptable outcome should apply to politics and participation as well. Let the winner win, let the loser lose, but be fair.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Malik in Dallas. Hi, Malik.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. Hello, Reverend Jackson.
To you, sir.
I'm an immigrant from India, and I'm a big supporter of your work. I just wanted to point a couple of facts to you. I think the focus of increasing minorities in the tech industry is you're doing a great job of pointing it out, but the focus should be on education, getting more minorities in educating in computer science and those fields. And the second thing I wanted to point it out about was the global nature of tech industry. Over the last 10 years, for example, IBM has more employees in India than they have employees in America. They keep growing in India because there's every other person, every second person who is graduating from a college in India is a computer science graduate. And that is not the case in America here. So those are the two points I wanted to make.
But they're also there because they're paying them lower wages and sending back here for a higher margin of profit. They're also exploiting cheap labor, whether it's India, Indonesia, China, as the case may be. On the other hand, the 60% of Silicon Valley is not tech. But know that tech, we should learn tech. And it should be taught. If you go to schools where you're tracked away from high math, and you if you live in a neighborhood where you don't have a computer at home or don't have one at school, you can't learn it. And so since it's important that we train youth rather than detain them, they're teachable. Train them. And so I think high-tech education is very important. And I was saying to students today, you should put a greater emphasis on just the culture of high-tech discipline. And don't choose, I mean, to study math. Don't take these away out and just be, I'm majoring in criminal justice, I'm majoring in social science. That has a place. We need social scientists, and no doubt about that. We need sociologists. That was my major. But the fact is, for the tech challenges, more technology is important. The chairman of Microsoft, who succeeded Bill Gates, is an African-American, John Thompson, graduate from Florida A&M University. The guy who wrote up the filing papers for Google is an African-American named David Drummond. So it's not something beyond our capacity, but we do know that they spend far more time with H-1 visas, bringing students in on temporary visas from Asia than they do trying to train youth at home. And that's not fair.
So you've had engagement with, you know, the 21st century style online organization for the things that you believe in, but you also were out in the streets and you were walking and marching and going door to door. And I wonder if you have concerns that today's brand of sort of being active with your phone or your computer gives people a sense that they have done more than they might have if they were to show up in person. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, there's nothing stronger ultimately than the pitter-patter of marching feet, if it comes to that. You would hope that research, education, negotiation would be enough to move the needle, and sometimes it does. But you think about these companies like Apple and eBay and the like, are fighting for the right to hide their employment data, fighting for the right to hide their taxes in offshore, I mean, like $23 trillion. I mean, fighting for the right to not be transparent, that's not the right fight. That fight has no moral foundation. Our government has some obligation to make them open the books. EEOC and contract compliance should be part of the understanding when they get these big deals.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jordan in Dallas. Hi, Jordan.
Hey, Chris. How are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious. Now, we talked about it twice today. As far as education being the backbone for solving the issue, if education and our property taxes really fund our schools, why is it that that problem or that structure hasn't been addressed so far, and how is it that we can actually make it happen? Because I think that we can definitely hear a lot of folks saying that we need to change that current funding system.
Well, the result is that you have I saw a basketball game between an inner-city Chicago school, Simeon, and then an out-of-city school, suburban school, play a basketball game. And the inner-city school won the basketball game, like, by 7 points. They won the big game. If those same kids had taken an exam, the suburban school would have won because they have greenhouses on campus. They have live livestock. They have vegetation. They have a computer behind every library stall. They teach higher math. They teach French, Spanish, and German. Well, hell, those kids who don't have any of that, they take the same exam. This school will not cost a stupid nuts because something wrong in their brain didn't have the same opportunity. So if we can even up the basketball court and see the results, if the basketball court, if one team had a lower goal than the other and played with two different balls, it wouldn't even be interesting as a game. So my point is let's get beyond thinking that there's a natural deficiency, even an effort deficiency, because effort and excellence means a lot. Inheritance and access means even more. And these budding networks must open up and let women in, let people of color in. And that's what affirmative action was really was all about, was saying that don't leave brain power women out. Don't leave blacks and browns out. It's not good. It's not right, whether it's in the military, whether it's in athletics or high tech. Let the tent include all of us, the big tent.
What's happened to the middle class in America?
Well, you have a combination of globalizing capital without globalizing human rights, without globalizing workers' rights and children's rights and women's rights and environmental security. So guns in, drugs in, jobs out. Whole industries. We lost 90,000 jobs in Cook County alone in Chicago to the NAFTA zone. That's just Cook County in Chicago. This whole industry went to cheap labor bases. You go to Indonesia and to Thailand, you see whole industries that shifted. We global. You can make a product there and send it back and put foreign content in the American car. And the American car really is the shell, but the content is made by workers making $3 and $4 a day. And so the American workers are at a very unequal position. When they had the Olympics in China a few years ago, inside the arena, we won some gold medals and we lost some. We won some silver medals. We won the most of them because women, blacks, whites could participate on the global stage of athletics. We won the Olympic medals. But outside of the Olympics, we would not win the academic medal, the capital medal, because the field is uneven. And we must know it's not a sustainable model to have us less educated in our formative years and expect production by importing foreign labor or by exporting our jobs to foreign countries.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet @ChrisBoydThink. I'd like to talk about Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who was released by the Taliban in exchange for 5 prisoners who were at Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. I know the details in that case have not been fully revealed to the public, but you have done some work in releasing prisoners who were held by foreign entities, and I wonder if you might have some perspective about how that might have worked behind the scenes.
Well, you know, when Lieutenant Robert, 2 American pilots went down in Syria, I had met a Assad before. This is Assad's father, mm-hmm. by the way.
This is 1983.
And President Reagan had protested vehemently against Jimmy Carter and how the Iranian hostages were being held. And my impression was if he would fight that way about the Iranian Americans held in Iran, he might not pay much attention to 1 soldier held in Iraq, in Syria. So that we inquired, and there was no real vigorous attempt to get the soldier out. And they say Rumsfeld had been there a couple of times, but if the record did not show he had really applied pressure to get him out. So we determined that we were going to Syria to make a moral appeal, a humanitarian plea, not a government plea, a humanitarian plea. Let the White House know that we wanted to go. We were not going in defiance. President Reagan's position to me was, I should not go because I don't know what I'm doing. But if I do go, bring him home, he would receive him. Well, we took the trip, and without it was not a government mission, but it was our government was aware of the mission. Mm-hmm. We got there; our ambassador was there, for example. The infrastructure was there, and after 3 days, we made an appeal. Enough appeals to Assad, he let Lieutenant Robert Gutman come home. Well, we didn't trade off anything. My sense was that whenever prisoners of war are set free. On those conditions, it opens up a window for dialogue. We brought Goodman back to the White House. President Reagan graciously received him. He asked me, Reverend Jackson, what can I do for you now that you brought our soldier home? I said, you can tell Assad thank you, which was a challenge. He called Assad, thanked him. They never stopped talking. The same is true when there were 3 Americans in Yugoslavia, and I went to see Milosevic. We were in the war. There were 3 soldiers held captive. And there was no plan that was obvious to bring the 3 soldiers out. We made the appeal to Milosevic, and we brought them home. We did the same thing in Cuba and in Colombia last year, as a matter of fact. So it seems to me that kind of third-person humanitarian plea without trade-offs has a certain way of handling it. But we've seen that happen before without trade-offs. I mean, you look at the The mention often the Israeli-Palestinian thing, those are trade-offs made. When wars wind down, you got to figure out somebody to get the combatants back home. It just seemed that everything in this instance went awry for some reason or the other. We were sold on this guy being a hero. He was a soldier, apparently not a hero. But to brought him home was to bring him home was the right thing to do. Deal with the challenges after he is home would be also the right thing to do. Some of the soldiers who were in his platoon who are now testifying against him, if they had done that before the fact, then he'd probably still be over there because he would not have been seen as worthy of risking other soldiers' lives. But there was a certain silence about him, and the presumption was he was there, captured by the Taliban, and he was a victim of their situation. Now we're getting a very different story. And I hope people do not politicize it. A, bringing him back was the right thing to do. Making him a hero, which he was not the right thing to do. But having Americans who are captured, knowing that their government and others are trying to get them home, is the correct thing to do. There's an American right there in North Korea, Kenneth Bay. I've been trying diligently to get into North Korea to appeal to the leader of that country to let him go. The same we did with an American who was in Colombia last year. We were able to negotiate his freedom. We did the same thing in the Gambia September a year ago to bring them home. So it's just so much more sensitive when it's coming from the White House, it seems.
So that if you are not directly associated with the White House, you have more latitude.
Yeah, you definitely have more latitude. And of course, now when you think about a guy who is seen as less than honorable coming home, where Americans were killed in pursuit of him, and then the five who were let go were such high-ranking members of the Taliban, it seems all out of kilter. But I think that we should not make this a matter to politicize. I think we are in a very difficult situation. I'm glad he's home. I hope that he'll face the appropriate challenges once he is home. But we should never leave a soldier on a foreign battlefield.
My guest is civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson. We are talking about diversity in the tech industry and the state of civil rights in America today. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is civil rights leader and two-time presidential candidate Reverend Jesse Jackson. All this month, KERA is presenting a series that looks back at the nascent civil rights movement in the summer of 1964. The Voices of Freedom Summer features North Texans who were on the front lines of the struggle for equal rights 50 years ago and younger people whose lives have been influenced by that history. The PBS documentary Freedom Summer will air on KERA Television June 24th, and the station will host a special screening here on June 17th. To find out how to RSVP and to hear stories from our series, The Voices of Freedom Summer, visit keranews.org. And now, if you want to join this conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Do you think, Reverend Jackson, that poor and working class Americans are divided along color lines and end up seeing one another as adversaries when, in fact, many of their interests are similar?
They're very similar. That's why President Lyndon Johnson, the most authoritative, transformative president since Abraham Lincoln, opened up the war on poverty in Appalachia. By opening up in Appalachia, he de-racialized the debate. He whitened the face of poverty, took away the assumptions about poverty. Black people who don't want to work, some. The hardest working Americans are coal miners, those who go down beneath the ground 2 or 3 miles every day. And yet they didn't have protection, didn't have security, didn't have education. Even today, a coal miner dies every 6 hours from black lung disease. He opened it up in Appalachia, and made it have mass application. And so when I was running for president, I tried to convince unemployed family farmers in Iowa that who were corporate farmers that taking their farm, and unemployed blacks in Chicago were corporate regions that taking their jobs away, had the same situation. They just saw each other through TV and not face-to-face. So I was trying to build linkages between the two. Today you have this governor refused to accept Medicaid money. Maybe $12 billion would be lost on the short term in the state. 42% of Texas's budget is federal government. If federal government money were cut off from Texas, it would go bankrupt this afternoon. They accept federal money for transportation, for highways, for hospitals, for University of Texas, Texas A&M, for risk subsidies for the water port, the airport. So federal monies are flowing into Texas every day, but not for Medicaid. And that is, I can't reconcile that with being a Christian, if you will, whose mission is, I was hungry and you fed me, or you didn't. Naked and you clothed me, or you didn't. In prison you visited me, or you did not. There seems to be something that's kind of hostile to poor people about that. And the reason why it's not just race, most poor people are not black or brown. They're white, they're female, they're young. Whether white, black, or brown, hunger hurts. And most folks who are on welfare work every day. They may be a TSA worker. They may work at the fast food restaurant, but they work every day. They may catch the early bus. They work every day. And still cannot make ends meet. We're too great a nation and too blessed to have so few so wealthy up top and so many so poor at the bottom and the middle class sinking. We must have some kind of economic democracy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Gary in Denton. Hello, Gary.
Hey, how are y'all this afternoon?
Great, thank you.
Hey, I heard Reverend Jackson's voice when I got off from lunch. I just had to take this opportunity to call in and thank him for his legacy. I was raised in Dallas. My father was a junior high school principal. And I was trying to remember precisely. It was either 1966 or 1968. And he had attended a presentation, and he came home that night with a cassette and a cassette player. And I remember he made the whole family come and sit around the dining room table and listen to this amazing speech he had heard. And it was Reverend Jackson. And my dad didn't do stuff like that, okay? The effect Reverend Jackson has had is profound and very far-reaching, and I just wanted to thank him for what he's done for this country. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, in a long battle, I've been blessed. I went to jail July 16, 1960. If you battle a lot, you strike out sometime, you get home run sometime, and you try to hope that your box score says you did better than worse. But I've been blessed to watch America grow. Involve our warps and sometimes false starts. And I think about when Dr. King gave the speech in Washington in 1963, from Texas across to Florida, up to Maryland, we couldn't use a single public toilet. The day he gave that speech, black and Latino soldiers had to sit behind knots of prisoners of war on American military bases that day. That day, our money was counterfeited. We could not buy ice cream at Howard Johnson. We couldn't rent a room at Holiday Inn. We were in the throes of rigid racial apartheid. And when you plant two seeds in the ground of equal strength, you put a wall between them, and one will grow tall with multiples of fruit, and one will not grow tall. The taller one is not a better one. It has something called sunshine, photosynthesis. It gets better. But when the walls come down, everybody can grow. And they all have multiples of fruit, and there's more abundance. So when I think, every time I see a Dallas Mavericks play or the Dallas Cowboys play or the Houston Texans play, I know, and the Rockets play, I know that that's because of the Civil Rights Movement, not because of some senator equivocating on racial opportunity. When I look at the big game tonight between the Spurs and the Miami Heat, I know what made that. Now, most people who won the game that will not associate at all those freedoms with civil rights, but that's exactly where they came from.
What do you remember as a young child? Were you always aware that people perceived some kind of important difference between people of different races, or was there a moment when it hit you for the first time?
Well, I was very aware. You learn the do's and don'ts early on. You learn the racial etiquette. You learn to go to the back of that bus. You learn not to drink water over there. You learn not to use that toilet. You learn not to sit in that public park. You're told early on why you can't use that skating rink, why you can't stop in the park and play ball with the other kids, why you can't swim. You learn the do's and don'ts in your formative years. I remember one of my first battles with it was I used to ride my father. He sold wood. My grandfather sold wood and coal. And I'd sit in the front of the truck with him, and I would count the money. He was teaching me to be a little man. Mm-hmm. The guys who worked for him couldn't count. And so I would count the money for them and help pay them with my granddad. And so I got a kind of front seat complex, you know. So one day I ran downtown with my mother. I ran down to the bus stop, and I go on the front. I sat right behind the driver because I was used to sitting behind the driver. And three white kids were sitting in front of me. They were having endless fun, making noise. They were having fun. I was sitting there alone looking out the window, as I always did when Granddad drove the truck. And so I heard the driver say, "There must be some order on this bus." He couldn't have been talking to me because I was quiet, you know, by myself, the three kids playing. Order! He was really talking to the adults in the back to tell me he was not going to drive until I got up. I must have been 7 years old. My mother came up front, and she pinched me. I was humiliated. I mean, and I cried. I hurt. In the back, I was resisting. She was snatching me along. And so one of my father's friends said, "She did that because she loved you." I could not understand that at all. He said, the back of the bus is going for the front to go. And if the bus have the wreck, folk in the back won't get hurt. They don't sit next to you. Don't sit next to him. He was teaching me how to survive in this capsule in the middle of this racial situation. And the driver said, "Read the sign above this head, boy." And the sign above the driver's head read, "Colored from the rear, whites from the front. Those who violate will be punished by law." Rosa Parks broke the law. She broke the civil law. That's why she was arrested. And the bus driver, he was legally right and morally wrong. We were in that kind of dilemma between our morality and our legality at that time. So as I felt that, I remember going to school the first day, right a mile from where we stayed. We walked past the schoolhouse with green grass and tulips and merry-go-rounds and the swings. And I looked forward to that. I was going, you're going to school next year. I just saw it in my mind's eye, going to school so I could be in the merry-go-round. And we walked out the door, and Mama pulled me to the left, went over to a school on the other side of the town that didn't have any grass. And we had to go 8 to 12, 12 to 4, because it was many of us, too many for one school. Hmm. And what they call the dual time system. And black teachers, by law, made less money than white teachers by law, though they taught two classes in the dual system. So you learn early on what that system is like. You learn to resent it. Now, you may adjust to it to avoid the pain of rejection. That pain may be being arrested. That pain may be a record. You can't get a job. But at some point in time, some people are blessed with the will where their cup runneth over. And I was blessed as an athlete to have a greater sense of what my capacity was and how wrong, how violated I felt in that process. One of the guys I met who was from here, Mel Counts, one of the great quarterbacks of our era who came from Dallas, Texas. Mel was just a great guy. And we went to Illinois together. I couldn't go to Furman, University of South Carolina. Couldn't go to the University of Clemson, which is 30 miles from my home. So you felt the limit. And ultimately, segregation does not so much hurt as it limits. Because if you live within your capsule, you pretty much learn you can go to church, you can go to school, you can get a job, you can get a house, you can have family. You can do a lot of stuff that takes away the sting. But ultimately, what segregation does, it limits your view of the other side of the town. You don't think about running for governor one day. It's beyond your zone, or running for U.S. Senator one day. It's beyond your zone. It's not realistic, you know, or running for president one day. Ultimately, segregation limits you. You begin to pray segregated prayers and have segregated dreams. You begin to accept the limitations of it. And that becomes the big challenge, to reject the limitations imposed upon you by unjust systems.
Do you find that young people today fully understand the history of the 20th century in America and how much changed over those years?
They don't understand, but neither do adults. I mean, the people who now call themselves, I was in South Carolina the other day where I'm from. My mother's quite ill, I mean, at this point. And Tea Party people are fighting for their politics. Rather hostile, it seems, towards civil rights. But that's the fastest growing city in the state of South Carolina, Greenville. And BMW is there, Boeing is there, and Honda there, Hyundai is there. The town, the state is growing. 1/4 of the state is in poverty. The governor sent back $12 billion in Medicaid money from the poorest of the poor people. The governor has a health insurance plan for herself, but sends it back for poor people. But those people who are working at Hyundai, who are working at Michelin, working at Boeing, they got those jobs. Not because they're hostile, but because we open the doors. The people, it's like this verse of the scripture that says when your children of Israel got across the Jordan River, say, tell them that they might know it, because if they do not know, they will ascribe their blessings to false gods. Make the real God angry. The New South owes its body, its growth, to the civil rights movement. That's why there should be those who listen should invest at Paul Quinn College today, a school with 250 kids. And she used to have 2,000 again. One of the great schools of our country was when it was Bishop College. Some of the great ministers of our nation came right out of that school, and leaders and teachers. You can't have a city as wealthy as Dallas and have a school as poor as Paul Quinn College. I mean, God will look upon us with a frown, unless we are measured by how we lift up those whose backs are against the wall. What a great opportunity!
So I'm going to tease you a little bit here. You've got great metaphors from the Bible, and you've got great metaphors from sports. Do you always instantly know which one will work in which situation?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a struggle to communicate and be heard.
Yeah.
And many of us relate biblically. We understand that language, that imagery. We understand the language of sports, and it has such broad application. I mean, when I think about Jesus the Christ, I think about an ethnic minority. He was born a Jew, and he died a Jew. He was not a Christian. He was born under the Roman Empire and under religious, corrupt religious oppression, the Sadducees and Pharisees. And on that death one, he had the debate about who his daddy was. And he overcame that. But Joseph and Mary hooked up. And they had to go to Egypt as a refugee, go to Egypt as an immigrant, as it were. And in the end, he came back as a poor, displaced person, born to a homeless couple, saying, my mission is very simple. I've been anointed to preach the gospel, good news to the poor. Heal the brokenhearted and set the captive free. That's not good. Why would anybody who believes that vote against food stamps for farmers, the truckers, and in the store? Why would anybody who believes that be anti-poor in that basic political putting culture over Christ? I don't think that's right.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson is a civil rights advocate and two-time presidential candidate. He spoke today at Paul Quinn College. And a minister.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help on the phones today from Christina Alsh. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.